This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. You know, every year millions of tourists travel to Florida in search of the Sunshine State's tropical splendor. From sandy beaches to amusement parks, Florida has become a southern paradise for eager vacationers as well as longtime residents. But back in the 1920s, the state didn't have that kind of mystical reputation. It took the Roaring Twenties and land in Florida growing cheaper and cheaper to spread word about this possible paradise. Soon, dreamers and schemers began to capitalize, and a new book chronicles the rise of Florida's image and the way it mirrored the hopes and delusions of the American public. The book is called For Sale, American Paradise, and its author is Willie Dry, who joins me in the studio. Willie Dry, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you for having me, Frank. I appreciate it. I can cross something off my bucket list today beyond The State of Things.
Well, thank you. You're very kind. But tell us now, this is interesting, the allure of Florida that begins in the 90s, because it's a swamp, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
So we'll get that out of the way now. But it becomes very popular. Tell us how this image changes.
Well, I thought that it's really rooted in the human desire to find a better place. I think people have been obsessed with that for as long as they've been people. And Florida started sort of getting on that radar after the Civil War when some travel writers, northern travel writers, started coming to Florida and discovered that, hey, you live down here, you might live longer. The climate's beautiful, the weather's warm, there just seemed to be an abundance. And so a series of travel writers came to Florida and started writing about it, and among them was Harriet Beecher Stowe, who, of course, President Lincoln started the American Civil War, basically, with her novel Uncle Tom's Cabin. And she came to Florida, bought some property there on the St. John's River near Jacksonville. Her son had been a Union Army soldier and had been badly wounded in the war. She bought property there, brought him down there thinking that he would, that maybe he would recover more quickly there. And eventually, Henry Flagler must have picked up one of these travel articles, and his wife had fragile health and came down there to, he brought her down there to see if that might improve her health. And he was charmed by the place also, decided, hey, I can make a little money here. Flagler, of course, was John D. Rockefeller's business partner, had amassed one of the great fortunes of that period, and saw an opportunity to build a railroad and build hotels, and he sort of invented Florida.
So you see here kind of all these currents come together, the rise of industrial capitalism in America, the rise of a wealthy class, which mm-hmm. is beginning to build vacation estates. This is mm-hmm. new, the Biltmore in Asheville, and we see vacation
right.
estates. And now a working class in the 20th century who can actually afford something called a vacation, right?
Right. Right. The working class came down a little bit later. Henry Ford's creation of the ability to build cheap automobiles really opened the doors for people of more modest means. And Carl Fisher, who developed Miami Beach, saw that opportunity early on and was one of the early lobbyists for the Dixie Highway, which brought tourists from the Midwest down to Miami. The new technology that was emerging at the time.
Credit, the rise of credit and the commercialization of Florida. Tell us more about
right.
that again.
The credit appeared sometime after the First World War. The First World War really upset everything as far as the state, the settled order of things. And one of the things that it did was the commercial credit, as you mentioned. People started buying things without them having the means to pay for them in full. That was something that would have horrified their Victorian ancestors, but there it was. You could go out, you could buy a radio cheap and a dollar down and a dollar a month or something like that. Of course, a dollar was worth a lot more then. But yes, that brought in the middle class, the people of more modest means. And they started piling into their Fords and heading south and becoming more and more fascinated the deeper into the Southland that they got.
And this story also includes its gaggle of crooks and scoundrels as well throughout the history. Let's start with the Ashley Gang.
The Ashley Gang In another setting, they might have just been rowdy country boys, but they were ruthless. They were determined. The patriarch, Joe Ashley, came over from the Florida West Coast in the late 19th, early 20th century to work on Flagler's Railroad. And Ashley was quoted in a newspaper. Now, I assume that that this was a true story, but it was quoted in the newspaper. His philosophy was that he didn't see why people wanted to stop his family from robbing banks. He saw it as kind of a stimulus plan that you know, we're going to rob the banks and we're going to spend it here. Money. So y'all shouldn't chase us. You should help us take the money. You know, that was kind of his philosophy. And his sons, particularly John Ashley, took
this, by the
that.
Way, is the birth of trickle-down economics.
Yeah,
We'll take all your money here at the top, and it'll eventually get to you.
But we'll let you have some of it back.
I like this. Keep going.
Well, the Ashleys were, they started out kind of as bootleggers. One of their early jobs was they attempted to rob a train of wealthy New Yorkers coming down on the Florida East Coast Railroad. And they stopped the train, they climbed aboard, very dramatic, guns being waved everywhere. And then they lost their nerve for some reason and sort of panicked and fled. And a day or two later, one of the passengers from New York, a woman from New York, was quoted in the New York Times describing, I mean, this train robbery made national headlines. And this woman was quoted as saying, well, they look like farmers. And that kind of gives you an idea of their appearance at the time. But eventually they sort of mastered their craft. They became more daring. They started robbing banks. They started going over to the Bahamas. Of course, you know, this is the year of Prohibition. And if you want to attract tourists to your state, they got to be able to get a drink. It's just not going to work if you can't get a drink somewhere. So the Ashleys would go over to the Bahamas. It was an fairly easy trip to the Bahamas. The British really didn't give a flip about American Prohibition. They were only too happy to sell it to them. And so the Ashleys would go to the Bahamas and load up and come back and sell it for an enormous profit. They also ran moonshine stills in the Glades. They were pretty much invulnerable. In the Everglades, they would go out, do a job of some sort, and the lawmen would chase them, and they would vanish into the Glades, and that would be that. And you wouldn't see them again until the next time they came out.
And then we've got evangelicals. William Jennings Bryan plays into the mm-hmm. history of the development of Florida.
Yeah, Bryan was another one of the folks who came to Florida. I think his first visit was 1912, and he had a wife with fragile health. Came to Miami. Maybe this will prolong my wife's life. Loved it. Bought property. Bryan preached. He became involved with buying and selling real estate, and he sort of preached it as a this is the place where God wants you to prosper. And come down here and buy, you know, some of this glorious property, and you will become wealthy, and you will become healthy, and you will live life the way it was intended. And he became fairly wealthy himself. He later tried to deny that he had really made a lot of money out of real estate, but he was eventually George Merrick, who was a great visionary, by the way. All of the people who became involved in this were not charlatans. There were men of great vision, such as George Merrick, who established Coral Gables, and Carl Fisher with Miami Beach. George Merrick hired, and we can talk a little bit more about this, but George Merrick hired Bryan to sell real estate in Coral Gables. And Bryan would set up a shop at a quarry that had been converted into a beautiful pool, and he would lecture every day about the wonders of Florida and the winds carry healing in their wings and things like that.
And a great story about a church that encouraged him to, you know, maybe give them a deal on some property.
Right. The New Yorker reported this. A group of church officials came to Bryan and asked him to sell them some property in Miami so that they could build a church on it. And they asked Brian to give them a reduced price. And according to the New Yorker, Brian refused to lower the price, but he did make them a counter offer. He said, if you will pay my price, I will come to your church and I will preach four sermons, and you will bring in so much money in the collection plate that it will more than offset what you pay for, you know, the extra price for the land. So you know, he could say what he wanted to, but he did have some idea how to make money.
How to make money. And, of course, the land grabs and the land schemes and the development fraud that went down there are legendary now. So much so, and this I didn't realize, but that the 1920s, the late play in the 1920s by George Kaufman, of course, starring the Marx Brothers, the Broadway hit Coconuts.
Mm-hmm.
It was really based on what was going on down there, right?
The Coconuts was a brilliant satirical take on the land boom. It appeared on Broadway in the mid-20s. The Marx Brothers were just getting started. Of course, movies were in their infancy then. But Coconuts was a roaring hit. It was praised by Time magazine and other publications. Time magazine, in fact, advised its readers that if you want tickets, you better be prepared to wait in line. And Groucho rips off some great one-liners in this script. He talks about he's selling property at his development, Coconut Manors, obviously a play on Coral Gables. And he's selling land at his auction, and he's telling the folks, well, you can get any kind of house you want. Why, you can get stucco. Oh, how you can get stucco. I can't do it with Marx's trademark leer, but, you know, it's a great satire.
Well, he's got this line in there, I think, too. If your property doesn't double in value in a year, I don't know what you can do about it.
Yeah, his personal guarantee,
Great stuff. So all this stuff is going on. You talked about the Ashley Gang kind of at one end of this cycle that you talk about, and you really take us through the Depression and into the early part. So we're not up to the 70s or 80s or any of that. But talk about Al Capone, because he kind of brackets this period that you're writing about.
Right. Capone was probably one of the shrewdest businessmen that this country has ever produced. He always said that he was only giving the public what it wanted, and he was right in that respect. And of course, he was he had a massive bootlegging organization. His income was astronomical. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it seems like one year his income was calculated at $180 million, and this is 1920s dollars, which would be a billion now, you know.
Man, he could run for president with that kind of money. But do go ahead.
Capone was a shrewd businessman. In the winter, the season of 1927-28, he came to Miami. Registered as Al Brown, and he registered at a hotel, the Hotel Ponce de Leon in Miami, and said he was a used furniture salesman, and spent a few months looking around, decided that he liked it, and sort of came out of his alias, and told people who he was, and he said that he was going to buy property in Miami, that he really liked it, and that his family was coming down. And he did eventually buy property on an island just off of Miami Beach. Capone saw tremendous opportunities there. And he created a bit of a stir in Miami and Miami Beach, because even then he was a household word. And there was one faction that wanted him out of there. By the time Capone came down, the boom was starting to fade a little bit. So people were very glad, at least some of the real estate dealers were very glad to get his infusion of cash.
Yeah. But did he practice his shenanigans there? There's an old mob saying that you don't do certain things where you eat.
Right,
and I wonder
if
he lived there and practiced elsewhere.
Well, he made a very close friend of a young young hotel owner, Parker Henderson Jr., and Henderson ran some errands for him and actually ended up buying some guns for Capone that were used in a gangland hit in Brooklyn. So
he's never not working. Right. He's never not working, that guy.
Right, right. But he's got buffers, you know, like they say in The Godfather, buffers.
The state's housing boom burst after the 1920s. How have you seen Florida develop as a state since then?
I think it has realized the promise and the potential that everybody saw for it back in the 20s, and we realized and exceeded it. If you go down there now, it really is a different place. The rules don't apply there, and they make a point of, I mean, they were even doing that in their advertising in the 20s. It's even more so now. Come to Florida because you deserve it. Come to Florida because it is a little bit of paradise. Every so often, though, something goes wrong. There were two terrible hurricanes that really crashed the boom, helped crash the boom in the 20s. 1992, Hurricane Andrew did something similar. There have also been booms and busts since then, or maybe a little bit smaller scale, but after the crash of 08, there was lots and lots of distressed property in Miami and the environs. So it does tend to be somewhat cyclical, but sooner or later it will recover because everybody could stand a little beach and a little sunshine, you know, every so often.
Willie Dry is my guest. He's the author of a book called For Sale, American Paradise, about the origins of Florida's boom and bust period during the early 20th century. He's going to be at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham next Wednesday at 7. And again, we've got that information at our website, stateofthings.org. Willie, great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Frank. I really enjoy this.
State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Shelton Ormond. Robin Copley's our technical director. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.